Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about three snapshots of the juvenile justice system in America. Author and journalist Jeff Hobbs spent as much as 3 years embedded in three locations that are typical of juvenile justice facilities across America. The Ferris School is very much a traditional juvenile justice center in Delaware for juveniles convicted of a crime. Woodside is a San Francisco detention center for youths awaiting trial, sometimes as long as a year or more. And Exalt, a diversion program in New York City, it trains students in life skills and provides job training in the technological fields. While the picture he paints can sometimes be bleak, there have been big improvements to the system nationwide. The number of detention has dropped by over 50% since the 1990s. That was the years of getting tough on crime, including juvenile crime. Oklahoma statistics are similar. But what Hobbs witnessed was a system catering to the poor, family dysfunctional kids with little or inadequate legal representation, which would offer ways around detention for a population that was overwhelmingly people of color in a system that, for the most part, fails to rehabilitate. In Children of the State, Stories of Survival and Hope in the Juvenile Justice System, Hobbs profiles several youths and the amazing teachers and mentors who are working within a flawed system to try to affect young lives. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Jeff Hobbs, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
This new book, Children of the State, follow some youths and three different spots in the American juvenile justice system. And unless you've interacted with the juvenile justice system, I think most of us have some severe misconceptions about who is in it and what takes place there. I know you've been writing about this for a while. What are our biggest misconceptions?
I guess it's the simple misconception. If you drive by a juvenile hall, say, outside your town, I think the immediate thought is just that that's where the bad kids are. And so you equate kids in juvenile hall with prisoners, and you probably equate teachers and counselors in juvenile hall with guards. And so I think the biggest misconception is not understanding that juvenile hall is school.
Yeah, I think most people would think of the juvenile hall as basically a detention center for young people who have broken the law and are too young to go to prison or go to jail.
Yeah, and then there's some truth to that. And some of the statistics are very similar to our adult prison system, especially when you're talking about recidivism. But I guess those misconceptions are what drew me into the world initially. And then it's a sad world. I'm not trying to say it's happy inside, but I got to meet some really bright kids, and I got to meet some really caring adults. I'm trying to shepherd them through a really hard passage. And that's what Children of the State came from. And what it's about is just those small moments of kids making their way through.
Now, I will say that at least at the end of the book, as of February 2022, the two students you profiled the most closely had at least left the system and were making a life for themselves in the world, albeit not a great life. You had one student who could have gone to college, could have graduated college. He was a smart guy who didn't. And another who was in a diversion program that would have allowed for really amazing work in coding and in the tech sphere. He didn't finish that program. And so on the positive side, they're kind of out of the system, but they really didn't take advantage of some opportunities that we would hope most kids would make the right choice about.
Yeah, true in both cases. And I mean, in my work, which you could call the journalism of hanging out, I mean, I just sort of go places where people let me and I hang around and talk to people, and I don't necessarily look for any particular narrative to follow. And especially in school, facilities where it's clumsy being a kid. And these two boys, Josiah is the one who had the chance to go to college, and Ian went through a really hard passage and ended up in this sort of very intensive life skills diversion program. And neither of them were ultimately able to follow through and finish on those opportunities. But along the way, they did learn an awful lot and grow an awful lot, and maybe not leading successful lives in the kind of storybook traditional sense, but they're doing pretty well. And I think they're good people.
Yeah. Compared to the average outcome, I would say they're well above average, and they're doing well by that standard. I want to ask you, in this book, you share three different pictures of our juvenile justice system. And given the fact that every state has its own system, are these three snapshots in a photo album, or do they represent systems that are pretty much in place in every state?
Yeah, so the juvenile justice system is state-based. There's no national template, but it does follow trends. And over generations and centuries, really, the trends have really oscillated back and forth between very severe and very humane. And in the 1990s, it was at a pretty severe low point, with just packed facilities and kids going to jail just for truancy and status offenses and schoolyard fights and, you know, not doing anything that bad. And in the 20 years since, the trend, not in every single state, but a pretty widespread trend, has been more toward humane treatment and education. And that manifests in slightly nicer rooms, a few more teachers, maybe yoga, sports teams. And so the system is getting better nationally, but I think these three snapshots that I ended up following present a picture of a system that still does serve the original purpose of the juvenile justice system, which is really just to get kids away, sort of, again, quote unquote, bad kids, get them out of sight, where they're no longer unsettling schools. I mean, I'm speaking in exaggerations to make a point. There is still that idea of just getting the bad kids out of here where we don't have to deal with them. And that's part of what I wanted to write the book about, counteracting that idea.
I was really struck by something. You know, you mentioned the fact that how conditions have changed in the system over the last 20 or 30 years. And the success rate, though, the recidivism rate, if you will, is still very low. And it certainly compares poorly to probation or diversionary programs. You put forth an interesting theory behind that low rate. And it's basically the very fact of putting a child, a young person, into one of these facilities sort of completes the work, if you will. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And I think what you're getting at very powerfully is the psychology of locks is deep and profound, and in some ways dooming for young people. I mean, particularly in the San Francisco Juvenile Hall, which much of this book is about, it's a court school where it's sort of like a holding facility where kids go once they've been arrested, but they haven't been put in front of a judge yet, but they're considered either because of their guardianship situation or what they've been accused of, they're considered not safe to release in the interim. So it's sort of like a county jail for kids. And so some kids are there with complicated cases for months or even close to a year, and some kids are only there for an afternoon while forms get sorted in the courthouse next door. And what I learned spending time there and following kids in and out and their families is even the kids who were just there for a couple hours still have to walk between the buildings in shackles, still have to hear that door slam behind them. And I'm really not taking any literary license here, that feeling changes you, and it makes everything that follows harder.
Before we talk about the three facilities that you write about, you sort of give us an overview of the system. For virtually any juvenile who enters the system, there are about 7 points of legal contact. And that's pretty constant throughout the United States. And you write that what happens at each of these contact points are profoundly affected by whether the family and the juvenile has access to money, to effective legal representation, and parental support. Can you maybe talk about these 7 points and how they determine who actually enters a juvenile hall?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting to learn about, and also a little bit chilling to learn about the process that goes on between a juvenile being arrested and a juvenile actually being adjudicated to a state care facility or school. And again, because the systems are locally governed, the contact points aren't all the same in every place, but basically there's 6 or 7 or 8 decisions made between arrest and adjudication that bump any given kid up the ladder toward a judge or sort of divert that kid into probation or community service or other options and other consequences. And so what I learned in short is that the reason these steps exist is to keep kids out of jail. There's just all these different steps where you can keep a kid out of court and out of jail. But what I learned is that that really only applies to kids whose families have the means to be present for those appointments and maybe hire an advocate or a defender. And so these steps that are designed to keep kids out of jail actually help funnel the poorest kids and the kids who have the least support into jail.
My guest today is Jeff Hobbs. He's an author and journalist. His new book is titled Children of the State, Stories of Survival and Hope in the Juvenile Justice System. It's published by Scribner. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as we mentioned earlier, you share 3 stories from 3 different facilities across the country. The first is in Delaware, the Ferris School, which struck me as sort of like a traditional detention center. What do we need to know about Ferris School?
Ferris has been around a long time. And in fact, I grew up in the area and I used to, as a not great JV football and basketball player, used to play against their teams. So Ferris is the only state care facility in the state of Delaware, which is not a big state. And it's where kids who have been through the court system go. So they have been adjudicated and sentenced to 3 months or 6 months, or usually not more than a year in state care. And so the kids can't leave, but it operates as much as it can as a school. So they get up and they walk down the hall and they go to English class and math class and history class and basketball practice throughout the day. And it was powerful to see, kids in the worst moments, the worst crisis points of their lives, still able to form the kinds of friendships and relationships with teachers that you might see in a supportive school environment.
Yeah, it struck me as sort of like a boarding school, but it's not a boarding school. It affects a sort of a boarding school image, at least in the portion that you were in, because I assume there are various levels of security at Ferris School, but certainly the one you were in sort of had this affectation of being sort of like a traditional boarding school, but certainly with a lot more rules, a lot more regulations, and, enforced confinement. There you follow a student named Josiah, who's a smart kid, who's someone who experienced way too much trauma in his life. I think he witnessed 3 murders prior to going to Ferris, and just a very tragic case, I believe.
Yeah, no, he saw a lot, Josiah did, and also no father in his life to speak of. I met him at an interesting, hard juncture in his life because he'd been in sort of a lower security environment in the same campus, actually, but down the hill, more of like a dorm style living environment for a nonviolent crime that he'd committed as a sophomore in high school. And he'd spent almost a year there. That's a place where you're confined, but you can go outside and play basketball and you can watch TV and you have some more choices. And then as soon as he got out of there, he went out with some friends and made some mistakes. And then he ended up another year in the higher security campus known as Ferris School. So I met him right when he was starting that year. And he was really, as you can imagine, sad, hard to connect with. But not long after I met him, he learned, because of all this time he'd been serving in the state system, he had actually accumulated enough contiguous high school credits to start considering graduating from high school. And if he was up for doing a little extra schoolwork, he might even have the potential to go to college.
In fact, he had a lacrosse scholarship and I guess went to college for maybe a week or two and dropped out.
Yeah, it was a lot, it was more than a couple of weeks. Yeah, it wasn't a long time. And it sounds just kind of like a hopeless story, I'm afraid. But if you read the book and sort of get to know Josiah, and you can understand how very limited the options are, even for a pretty bright kid who made some mistakes outside, but when he was in the system, he formed positive relationships with kids and adults, and he made really good decisions, and he worked really hard. And yeah, he played lacrosse at Ferris School, which is kind of interesting on its own. But most institutions, as you can imagine, even vocational colleges or vo-tech schools, aren't really open to kids with criminal records. And so the only kind of viable path he had was to this community college in the center of New York State, in a very rural area, very far from Josiah's home. And because of the timing of his release, he had to start in the middle of winter, and it was during the pandemic, so the campus wasn't full. And so you can imagine taking this kid who'd been supported pretty intensely by, again, very caring teachers around him, suddenly getting off a bus in the middle of a different state in the dark of winter, and just sort of trying to make his way into a totally alien environment. You can imagine how lonely that probably felt. Yes, so he didn't stay there long.
And that's one thing that sort of struck me about a number of the kids you wrote about in this book is that, you know, even if their home life is chaotic, if their peer groups have some unhealthy relationships, you pull those kids out of those relationships, it's almost a trauma in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much to add to that. I think you're exactly right. And that's something that in the greater societal narratives that we like to cling to isn't often considered, just the value of friendship and the stability of friendship when you're sort of moving kids around like this.
And yet it's also a quandary for people who are making decisions in situations like this, because those unhealthy relationships also have unhealthy results oftentimes. My guest today is Jeff Hobbs. His new book is titled Children of the State, Stories of Survival and Hope in the Juvenile Justice System. And he profiles three different justice facilities across the country. The second is a juvenile detention center in San Francisco Woodside, which all through the book, you write that this is scheduled to be closed. And you focus on a teacher and a principal, Chris Lanier, the principal, and English teacher Megan Mercurio. And they're incredibly dedicated professionals working at this facility. And yet there's this sort of Damocles, you know, that the fact that this facility is going to be closed. Well, I just looked online today. It's still open today. And you really write about these teachers. And I think that's one of the unsung heroes is, you know, these people that work in this system are seem to be incredibly motivated, incredibly dedicated to the students that they run across in these facilities.
Yeah, those are two, Chris and Ms. Mercurio, who you mentioned, obviously people I admire a lot. And I would just, the first day I met Megan, I was, I didn't really know anybody in the juvenile hall yet, but she was taking me to the courthouse next door to get like credentials so that I could hang out there. And she seemed, I knew she was the English teacher and she seemed like a sweet person. She seemed really kind of sad and internal that day. And I just asked her if she was all right. And she said she wasn't all right because she just learned that a kid she'd taught who'd been in juvenile hall a lot, but she had enjoyed him. He was a good student and he'd gotten out and he was doing pretty well. And she had just learned the day before that he'd been murdered outside. And she said she was grieving for him, but she also knew that chances were before too long, she would have his murderer in her classroom in the juvenile hall. And she would be, whoever that kid was, she would be teaching him how to write poems and discuss books. And that happened. She did have that kid in her class for almost a year. He's one of the kids who's still at the juvenile hall, which, as you mentioned, is still open. And she actually formed a remarkable relationship with that student.
You know, it sounds like this facility was, as you would expect in San Francisco, somewhat on the progressive side, but it sounds like there have been forces that have basically said, we're not going to do some of this stuff that we did that, you know, as you mentioned, yoga. I think one of the first times you were visiting with a class, Megan has them outdoors and they're learning how to put together spring rolls. So obviously she had a very interesting way of interacting with these students and trying to engage them on all sorts of levels.
Yeah. And you meet teachers, again, in pretty difficult environments and, most of them volunteer, but some work for the school district and maybe are assigned here or it was the only spot open in a given moment. And teachers have different styles. Like some have kind of invisible walls between themselves and the trauma around them because they carry a lot and it's just their way of coping. And Megan was one who had no walls, no boundaries. She carried everything. She cries all the time, but carries on. And again, she said she has the knees of an aging baseball catcher because she spends so much of her day just kind of squatting beside desks so that she can look kids in the eye at their level. So I think that sums up a lot of the kind of person and educator that she is and people she works with.
Now, the third story focuses on a diversion program, Exalt, in New York City. And we mentioned Ian earlier, who was diverted there. Tell us a little about Exalt. And is this a better way than a traditional juvenile hall?
Yeah, so Exalt, again, is a place I admire greatly. And they were also really nice to let me hang out. And so they take kids who have been through the system, been through juvenile hall, and as part of their probation, they go into Exalt, which is this four-month sort of intensive life skills program. And the first half of that, they go to their regular schools during the day. This is in New York City, so you have kids from all the five boroughs, the Bronx and Brooklyn and even New Jersey. And yeah, they get themselves to this classroom every day after school from 4 to 6. And they just talk about kind of the hard realities of life and how to get a job and keep a job and all these demands that society makes of kids who don't have much support. And then the second half of the program, they actually work these also pretty intense internships, paid internships. And so the idea behind it is you give these young people really intense challenges and responsibilities, but you also give them really intense support and faith. And not everybody makes it through the program, but it is a good way. And kids who do make it through 100% graduate from high school. I don't think they're allowed to say 100% just because we can't speak in absolutes, but say 99.5%. The issue is that it is expensive to give that much attention. And so politically, that's a hard one.
Yeah. So let me ask you, in our brief time left, you've looked at these three particular facilities. Do you come up with any conclusions on how we need to change our system of handling juvenile crime and what we do with these kids when they enter the system?
Sure. I mean, I'm not the kind of writer who's here to like make proclamations or announce that I or any one person sort of has the solution to a problem that, again, is centuries old and the country has never really dealt with very progressively, even still today in a city like San Francisco. But I would just say that in the system, which locally, maybe it's 20 or 30 kids in any facility, but if you add it up across America, you're talking about 250,000 kids roughly in the span of a year who are locked up. And that's a lot. And I've talked about how dooming that can be even for a short time. And most of those kids haven't done anything that bad. Maybe they got in a fight or broke a window impulsively, stole some things. I mean, they've done things there need to be consequences for, but I don't think they need to be locked up. And I think if you can divert those kids into a program like EXALT, and then all the resources we do have for the juvenile justice system can focus on the kids who really do need it, I think you'd get a lot better statistics at the end of the day.
The name of the book is Children of the State. Jeff, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Rich.
Journalist and author Jeff Hobbs speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Children of the State, Stories of Survival and Hope in the Juvenile Justice System. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. I'm so happy to be back, and thank you so much for listening today.